A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a follow-up to something we talked about before. The idea of a state guaranteeing housing, food, and a job. But this time, he wants to strip out the job guarantee, and just keep the basics, shelter, calories, and healthcare. And the real question is, does that look any different from what already exists? Public housing, food stamps, Medicaid, isn't this just rebranded welfare? Or is there something structurally different about a guarantee versus conditional assistance?
That's the tension right there. On the surface, it sounds like what we already have, just with better marketing. But the listener is making a specific argument that I think gets overlooked in these discussions. He's saying the permanent risk of homelessness creates a background anxiety that's harmful even when things are going well. Even when you're currently housed, currently fed, the knowledge that you could lose it all is itself a public health problem.
Which is a claim about psychology, not just economics. He's basically saying the safety net and the stable anchor are two different things, and we've built the first while pretending it's the second.
And that distinction, safety net versus stable anchor, that's where the whole conversation turns. A safety net catches you when you fall. An anchor means you're not being swept away in the first place. They operate on completely different assumptions about what security means.
Let's unpack what the listener is actually proposing, because on the surface it sounds familiar, but the details matter.
So the stripped-down version is three things. The state guarantees basic housing, basic food, and basic healthcare. No job component, no work requirement, no means testing in the traditional sense. It's a citizenship-based entitlement. You exist, you're a legal resident, therefore these things are yours.
Which immediately raises the question, how is that different from Section 8 and SNAP? I mean, those programs also provide housing and food assistance.
They do, but the mechanics are completely different. Let's take U.S. public housing first. There are about 1.2 million households in public housing right now, but roughly 4.5 million are eligible. The wait lists in major cities average 2.5 years. In New York, it's closer to 8 years for some developments, so even if you qualify, you're not actually housed. You're waiting. And during that wait, the anxiety the listener is describing doesn't go away. It might even get worse, because you've done everything right and still nothing's happened.
The very existence of a wait list creates the condition the program is supposed to solve.
And that's before we get to the welfare cliff problem. SNAP, for example. If you're a single able-bodied adult without dependents, you can only get 3 months of benefits in a 3-year period unless you're working at least 20 hours a week or in a training program. If you get a small raise and your income ticks above the threshold, you lose benefits entirely. So the system is designed with these sharp drop-offs that punish exactly the behavior we claim to want, earning more, working more, improving your situation.
The listener's proposal, by contrast, doesn't have a cliff because it doesn't have means. Testing in that sense. If it's universal, you don't lose housing because you get a raise.
That's the structural difference. Existing welfare is conditional, means, tested, and bureaucratic. You have to prove you're poor enough, prove you're looking for work, prove you meet asset limits. In some states, you can't have more than $2,000 in savings and still qualify for SNAP. The listener's proposal is unconditional and universal. No asset test, no work requirement, no proving you're desperate enough. It's the difference between applying for a benefit you might not get and having a right you can rely on.
That word right is doing a lot of work here, because public housing in the U.S. isn't a right. It's a program subject to appropriations. Congress could zero it out tomorrow.
That's exactly the point. In a 2024 paper in the Journal of Social Policy, researchers tracked cortisol levels in people in precarious housing situations, people who were currently housed but on month-to-month leases or facing possible eviction. They found elevated cortisol equivalent to chronic stress, even when nothing bad was currently happening. The threat alone was enough to produce measurable physiological effects. That's the background anxiety the listener is describing, and it has empirical backing.
Which means the current system creates anxiety by design. Not intentionally, but structurally. You're always one missed paycheck, one landlord's whim, one bureaucratic error away from losing your housing. Even if you've never missed a rent payment, the knowledge that you could, and that there's nothing beneath you if you do, that's the background hum.
This is where Israel becomes a really useful case study, because the listener mentioned tenancy at will, and it's worth explaining what that actually means in practice.
Having lived it, go ahead.
In Israel, the vast majority of rental contracts are for 1 year, and after that first year, they typically convert to month to month. The landlord can terminate with 30 days' notice for essentially any reason. There's no rent control in most of the country, so your rent can jump 20 or 30% at renewal, and if you can't pay, you're out in a month. According to the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics, about 70% of tenants are on these month-to-month arrangements, compared to about 25% in the EU. And 68% of Israeli tenants report anxiety about lease renewal.
68%. That's not a fringe experience. That's the norm.
And contrast that with Germany. Where rental contracts are typically indefinite, rent increases are capped at 15% over 3 years in tight markets, and eviction requires cause. Or France, which has a winter eviction moratorium. You literally cannot be evicted between November and March. The psychological difference between knowing you can be out in 30 days and knowing your landlord needs a court order that takes months is enormous.
The Israeli system is basically the Platonic ideal of the background anxiety generator. Maximum flexibility for landlords, minimum security for tenants, and the market's humming along just fine. Except for the part where most of the people in it are stressed out of their minds.
Here's the thing. Israel actually has public housing, but it's tiny. Something like 25,000 units total, with waitlists that stretch for years. So the vast majority of low-income Israelis are in the private rental market, subject to exactly these dynamics. The state provides a housing safety net that catches almost nobody, while the market generates the anxiety the listener is describing. It's a perfect illustration of why the safety net and the anchor are different things.
Let me push on something here. If the proposal is just unconditional housing, food, and healthcare, isn't that just a more generous version of the Nordic model? Denmark, Sweden, they already have strong social housing sectors and universal healthcare. What's the difference?
It's a good question, and the difference is subtle but real. In Denmark, social housing is allocated through waitlists that are open to everyone, no income test, but you still have to wait. In Sweden, the wait for a rent-controlled apartment in Stockholm can be a decade or more, so even in the Nordic model, housing isn't actually guaranteed in the sense the listener means. You have a right to apply, not a right to receive. The listener is proposing something closer to a legal entitlement. If you need housing, the state must provide it, full stop, no waitlist.
It's the difference between you're eligible for the program, and here are the keys.
And that distinction matters enormously for the anxiety mechanism. If you know the state has a legal obligation to house you, not just a program that might have space, the background hum changes. You're not hoping the system works, you know it has to.
There's a flip side here, though, which is cost. If the state has an unlimited obligation to provide housing, doesn't that create a massive fiscal exposure? What's stopping millions of people from saying, "Great, free apartment, please"?
This gets to the economic feasibility question, and it's where a lot of the debate actually lives. The CBO did an analysis in 2025 that estimated a universal housing guarantee in the U.S. would cost between $200 and $400 billion annually, compared to about $70 billion for current housing assistance. That's a big number.
It's also roughly what we spend on the mortgage interest deduction, which overwhelmingly benefits higher-income households.
I was going to say, the mortgage interest deduction costs about $30 billion a year, and something like 60% of that goes to households earning over $100,000. So when people say we can't afford a housing guarantee, what they often mean is, we've already chosen different priorities and labeled them normal rather than welfare.
The mortgage interest deduction is just welfare for people who already have houses. It's not called that, but functionally, it's a housing subsidy with an income floor instead of a ceiling.
This is where the listener's framing gets interesting, because he's essentially saying, what if we took all the existing housing subsidies? The mortgage interest deduction, the property tax deductions, Section 8, public housing, and replaced them with a single universal entitlement. The math might actually work, or at least be closer than the sticker price suggests.
Let's talk about the moral hazard objection, because it's the first thing anyone raises. If you guarantee housing and food with no work requirement, won't people just stop working?
The evidence doesn't really support that. Let's look at the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. This has been running since 1982, paying every resident about $1,600 a year, no strings attached. It's not a full basic income, but it's unconditional cash. Multiple studies have found no significant reduction in employment. In fact, Alaska's employment rate has consistently been above the national average.
Though to be fair, $1,600 a year isn't enough to live on, so the incentive effects might be different at a full subsistence level.
That's a fair caveat, but the broader UBI literature is helpful here. A 2025 meta-analysis of UBI pilots across multiple countries found a 1-2% reduction in work hours on average, but a 5-7% increase in entrepreneurship and education. People didn't stop working. They shifted toward more productive, long-term investments in themselves.
Which makes intuitive sense. If your survival isn't tied to keeping a terrible job, you might take a risk on starting a business or going back to school. The current system punishes exactly those kinds of risks.
There's a health cost angle here that often gets missed. A 2023 study in health affairs found that housing instability adds about $12,000 per person per year in emergency room visits alone. People who are housing insecure use the ER as primary care. They delay treatment until things are acute and the costs cascade, so some portion of the housing guarantee cost is offset by reduced healthcare spending.
Which loops back to the listener's inclusion of healthcare in the guarantee. If you're providing all three, housing, food, healthcare, the interactions might produce savings that looking at each in isolation would miss.
A housed, fed person with access to preventive care is dramatically cheaper than an unhoused, hungry person showing up in the ER in crisis. The current system effectively pays for the crisis while underinvesting in the prevention.
Existing welfare is conditional and targeted, but there are models around the world that get closer to the listener's vision. Let's look at three of them.
The obvious starting point is Finland's Housing First program. This began as a targeted intervention for the chronically homeless, but the philosophy behind it is exactly what the listener is describing. The core principle is, housing is a human right, not a reward for good behavior. You get housing first, no preconditions, no sobriety requirement, no requirement to engage with mental health services, no requirement to prove you're trying. Then, once you're housed, support services are available if you want them. Since 2017, Finland has reduced homelessness by about 35%. 4,000 people have been housed through the program, and 80% retained their housing after 2 years. Critically, the program saved about 15,000 euros per person annually in emergency services, hospital visits, police interactions, shelter costs. So it wasn't just more humane, it was cheaper than the alternative.
Housing First is targeted at the already homeless. The listener's proposal is universal. It's for everyone, not just those who've already fallen through the cracks.
That's the key limitation. Housing First proves that unconditional housing works for the most vulnerable population, but it doesn't tell us what happens when you extend that logic to the entire population. The listener is essentially arguing for housing first for everyone, a universal floor rather than a targeted intervention.
What about Brazil's Bolsa Família? That's often cited as a successful large-scale welfare program.
Bolsa Família is interesting, but it actually illustrates the difference between conditional and unconditional approaches. It's a cash transfer program that reaches about 14 million families, enormous scale, but it requires school attendance and vaccination compliance. If your kids don't go to school, you lose the benefit. So it's a conditional cash transfer, not a guarantee in the listener sense. It's using the benefit as leverage to shape behavior, which is philosophically very different from saying, this is yours regardless.
Though you could argue that school attendance is a reasonable condition. It's not a work requirement. It's investing in the next generation.
And Bolsa Família has been remarkably successful at reducing poverty and improving education outcomes. But the listener's thesis is specifically about the anxiety created by conditionality itself. Even if the conditions are reasonable, they create a mechanism by which the benefit can be lost. And that mechanism, that possibility of loss, is what generates the background stress.
Even well-designed conditional programs don't provide the stable anchor. They provide a better safety net, but it's still a net.
The UK's on HS is actually a closer parallel in one dimension. It's universal healthcare, free at the point of use, no means testing, no conditions beyond residency. And it's enormously popular. There's a reason it's called the closest thing the English have to a national religion. The NHS demonstrates that a universal, unconditional entitlement can work at scale and become politically untouchable. But it only covers healthcare, not housing or food.
None of the existing models actually do all three unconditionally. Finland does housing, but only for the homeless. Brazil does cash, but with conditions. The UK does healthcare universally, but stops there. The listener's proposal is combining all three without conditions, which is genuinely novel as a package.
That package matters because the interactions between the three components are where a lot of the value lives. If you have guaranteed housing but no guaranteed food, you're still one crisis away from choosing between rent and groceries. If you have housing and food but no health care, a medical emergency can wipe you out and cost you both. The three together create a floor that's greater than the sum of its parts.
Let me raise the dignity question, because the listener mentioned it in the context of the job guarantee. Without a job component, how do people buy shoes for an interview? How do they afford transportation? The proposal covers the absolute basics, but there's a gap between survival and participation in society.
This is the strongest objection to stripping out the job guarantee, and the listener acknowledges it. Housing, food, and healthcare keep you alive and healthy, but they don't give you purchasing power for anything else. You're not hungry and you're not on the street, but you also can't buy a bus pass or a phone or a decent shirt. There's a dignity gap.
Which is why the original proposal included the job guarantee. It was meant to provide exactly that purchasing power for the non-essentials that make life feel like life rather than mere survival.
And this gets at a deeper philosophical question. Is the state's obligation to keep people alive or to enable them to participate in society? The listener's stripped-down proposal answers, keep them alive, healthy, and housed. The original version with the job guarantee answered, enable participation. There differ visions of what the social contract requires.
Though you could argue that keeping people alive and healthy is the prerequisite for everything else. If you're not worried about where you're sleeping tonight, you're in a much better position to figure out the shoes and the bus pass on your own.
That's the listener's thesis exactly. The stable anchor frees up cognitive and emotional bandwidth for everything else. There's research on this, the concept of scarcity and cognitive load. When you're constantly worried about basic survival, your decision-making suffers. You make worse choices not because you're bad at making choices, but because your mental bandwidth is consumed by survival calculations.
The classic example is the sugarcane farmers in India, who show measurable IQ drops before the harvest when money is tight, compared to after the harvest when they're flush. Same people, same skills, but scarcity itself impairs cognitive function.
That's the mechanism by which the background anxiety the listener describes causes real harm. It's not just that being stressed is unpleasant, it's that being stressed makes you worse at everything else. Worse at parenting, worse at job hunting, worse at managing money, worse at health decisions. The anxiety creates a downward pull that makes escape harder.
The listener's proposal isn't just about material well-being. It's about creating the psychological conditions for people to function at their best. The material guarantee is the mechanism, but the outcome is human flourishing, not just absence of deprivation.
Which brings us to the political question. Because if you frame this as, let's give people free stuff, it's dead on arrival in a lot of countries. But if you frame it as, let's remove the cognitive tax that's making everyone less productive and more expensive to the healthcare system, it starts to sound like an investment rather than a giveaway.
The listener's framing of stable anchor is actually quite clever politically. It's not about dependency. It's about providing a foundation from which people can build. The anchor doesn't stop you from sailing. It stops you from drifting into the rocks.
The evidence from places like Alaska and Finland suggests that when you provide that foundation, people don't actually become dependent in the way critics fear. They use the stability to take productive risks. The Alaska Permanent Fund hasn't created a state of layabouts. It's created a state where people have a small cushion and use it.
Let me push back on one thing, though. The Alaska dividend is $1,600 a year. That's not a housing guarantee. It's a nice bonus. The listener's proposal is orders of magnitude more expensive per person. Can we really extrapolate from Alaska to a full subsistence guarantee?
It's a fair point, and I don't think we can extrapolate directly. The scale is completely different. But the principle, that unconditional transfers don't destroy work incentives, that seems to hold across a wide range of amounts and contexts. The UBI pilots in Kenya, where GiveDirectly has been running a 12-year experiment with monthly payments, have found similar results. People don't stop working. They shift toward more productive activities.
The moral hazard objection, while intuitive, doesn't have much empirical backing, at least not at the scales that have been tested.
The real objection isn't empirical. It's philosophical. It's about whether we think people deserve to have their basic needs met regardless of their choices. And that's not a question research can answer. That's a values question.
Which is probably why the listener framed it in terms of anxiety and well-being rather than desert. He's sidestepping the desert question entirely and saying, regardless of what anyone deserves, the current arrangement produces measurable harm. The background anxiety is a public health problem, and this is the intervention.
That's a much more interesting argument than the usual, housing is a human right framing. Not because I disagree with that framing, but because it doesn't persuade anyone who doesn't already agree. The public health framing says, even if you don't care about rights, you should care about this, because it's making society worse in measurable ways.
Higher cortisol, worse decision-making, more ER visits, lower productivity. These are costs we're already paying. The question is whether we want to pay them through a guarantee or through the downstream effects of not having one.
Where does this leave us? The listener's proposal isn't just a tweak. It's a different category of social contract. Here's what that means.
The structural difference is real. Existing welfare is conditional, means-tested, and bureaucratic. You have to prove you're poor enough, you have to behave correctly, and you can lose benefits through no fault of your own. The listener's proposal replaces conditionality with universality, means, testing with citizenship, based entitlement, and bureaucratic discretion with a legal guarantee.
The key insight is the background anxiety mechanism. Existing welfare reduces material deprivation, and that's valuable. SNAP keeps millions of people fed, Medicaid keeps millions alive. But it doesn't eliminate the fear of falling through the cracks. That fear itself is a public health issue, with measurable physiological and cognitive effects. The safety net catches you when you fall. The stable anchor keeps you from being swept away.
The evidence from Housing First, the Alaska Dividend, and UBI pilots suggests that unconditional approaches don't produce the dependency critics fear. They produce stability, and stability enables exactly the kind of risk-taking and long-term investment that market economies supposedly reward.
For listeners interested in this idea, the real-world experiments to watch are local Housing First initiatives and the larger UBI pilots. The debate is moving from, should we do this, to, how would we design it? The Finnish example shows that Housing First works and saves money. The Alaska example shows that universal, unconditional transfers are politically durable. That program has survived 40-plus years and multiple changes of government.
The listener's framing of stable anchor versus safety net is a useful distinction that clarifies what's actually being proposed. Most welfare debates get stuck on the safety net question. How generous should it be? Who should qualify? What conditions should apply? The listener is asking a different question entirely. What would it take for people to feel fundamentally secure, such that the fear of destitution isn't coloring every decision they make?
That question becomes more urgent as labor markets shift. Current projections from the McKinsey Global Institute suggest about 14% of jobs are at high risk of automation by 2030. That's millions of people whose relationship to the labor market is about to change dramatically. The idea of decoupling survival from employment stops being radical and starts being practical when employment itself becomes less reliable.
Though I'd add, we don't need the automation argument to justify this. The listener's point about the Israeli rental market, 70% month-to-month, 68% anxious, that's not about robots taking jobs. That's about a housing market that generates insecurity, even for people with steady employment. The problem isn't just job loss. It's that the housing market itself is a source of precarity.
Even if you have a good job, if your landlord can terminate your lease with 30 days' notice and raise the rent 20%, you're not secure. The job is secure, but the housing isn't, and that disconnect is exactly what the listener is trying to address. The guarantee doesn't replace employment. It provides a floor that employment alone can't guarantee.
If we accept the listener's premise, what's the next step? Do we need a constitutional amendment, or can this be done through legislation?
That depends on the country. In the U.S., a housing guarantee would almost certainly require legislation rather than a constitutional amendment. Congress has the power of the purse, and most welfare programs are statutory. But making it a legal entitlement rather than a discretionary program would require a shift in how the law is written. Right now, housing assistance is subject to annual appropriations, which means it can be cut or eliminated by any Congress. An entitlement, like Social Security or Medicare, is a permanent legal obligation.
Which is why making it a right rather than a program matters so much. Rights aren't subject to the appropriations process. You can't decide this year's budget doesn't include the Fourth Amendment.
That's the ultimate difference between the listener's proposal and existing welfare. It's the difference between, we have a program that might help you if there's funding, and the state has a legal obligation to house you, period. That shift from discretion to obligation is what would actually eliminate the background anxiety. You can't be anxious about losing something that can't be taken away.
Maybe the most radical idea here isn't the guarantee itself, but the admission that the current system creates anxiety by design. We've built a welfare state that helps people but also keeps them on edge, and we've convinced ourselves that the edge is necessary, that without the threat of losing everything, people would stop trying. The evidence says otherwise.
That's the thought I want to leave listeners with. The listener's proposal isn't just about spending more money or expanding existing programs. It's about rethinking the relationship between the state and the citizen at a fundamental level. Not, we'll help you if you qualify and behave correctly, but you belong here, and belonging comes with a floor beneath which you cannot fall.
If you have a weird prompt about rethinking the social contract, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 720s, French cartographer Guillaume de Lille produced a map of Africa that placed the supposed Christian kingdom of Niamey in what is now South Sudan, a misattribution based on garbled Portuguese missionary reports that had conflated several distinct regions. The error persisted in European atlases for nearly 60 years until James Reynolds' 1798 map corrected it using triangulated travel accounts.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're Herman Poppleberry and Corn the Sloth, and we'll be back with another weird prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.